grazing capabilities. The experience of all persons traveling through this region has been that from the Columbia to the Missouri rivers, finer grasses have never anywhere been seen. The number and condition of the stock that feed upon the wild grass alone shows both their abundance and nutrition. Wild hay can be and is cut from thousands of acres. The grass is mostly a wild bunch grass, growing from 12 to 18 inches high and covering the entire country. Horses and horned stock by thousands and sheep by hundreds all bespeak the wealth that is wrapped up in the native grasses of the North Pacific region, and I confidently look forward to seeing the wealth of these beautiful mountain valleys yet consistent in the thousands of fleecy flocks to be here sheared. And if the streams of the Rocky Mountains are themselves caught and harnessed in the spindles and looms of wool manufactories to be there erected, that the annual shipments of wool to a St. Louis market will constitute a trade replete with wealth and magnitude. I believe it to be an ordination of Providence that the buffalo that now blacken the western plains by their millions of shaggy coats disappear with the red man, whose sustenance they now are, their place will be supplied by the silvery fleeces of millions of sheep tended by white men, which this region is capable of sustaining. The wolves now exist in places as an impediment to much attention being given the subject, but travel and settlement soon destroy them. The premiums on cotton, which is soon to be transferred to wool, render this question one of great magnitude for this region, and I yet hope to see the genial valleys of the Rocky Mountains send to a St. Louis market via the upper Missouri River its cargoes of wool and its shipments of gold as its natural tribute to our national wealth, mineral wealth. It has been only during the last 3 years that sanguine expectations have existed of mineral wealth to any great extent being found east of the Cascade Mountains, or even in the northern portion of the Rocky Mountains proper. As soon as the Fraser River mines in British Columbia were discovered, and the question of route by which to reach them in the shortest time and cheapest means was discussed, we found the eastern portion of Washington Territory ramified by hundreds of gold seekers in quest of this new El Dorado. This was in 1858. Gold was soon after discovered in the Wenatchee, Natchez, Okanagan, Similkameen, and Clark's Fork, worked till the Indians drove the miners from the country. In the succeeding year, Captain Pierce, with a boldness and judgment worthy every commendation, explored the Bitterroot Mountains, and the discovery of the Nez Perce gold mines was the result. The wanderings of the miners in this region southward led to the Salmon River discoveries, but the gold miner, who is the most restless of mortals, did not rest content until he had crossed Snake River and discovered the Powder River mines, and not even then content he opened up the Grand Ronde, Boise, and Burnt River mines in East Oregon, and elated at his success, returns to his friends in West Oregon, taking the head of John Day's River in his route, only to discover the richest quartz leads to be found outside of California. His companions on Fraser's River heard of this new gold field, and they too must visit it, taking on their route the mouth of Clark's Fork and Spokane River, only there to discover gold which has since been taken out by the pound. This news spreads, and the Powder River miner tracks it to the latter point and thence to the Kootenai, where he is amply repaid for his toil and travel. While this is being done, the Salmon River miner is not content with making $20 per day, but he too must follow the Salmon River till it becomes a silvery thread in the mountains and crosses the range to discover the wealth of the Deer Lodge mines. As the weary emigrant crossing the plains hears of this El Dorado so near himself, he too must journey thither only to discover the rich gold mines in Big Hole and Beaver Head valleys. Nor does it stop here, but the restless adventurer in St. Louis contracts the gold fever and threads the Missouri to Fort Benton in quest of the Deer Lodge mines, and while en route discovers the Prickly Pear gold mines. Thus, working like beavers, have the miners and emigrants crossed and recrossed the mountains during the last 3 years, ramifying in every direction until they have opened a gold region which today is sending to our mints a wealth equal to that of all California in her palmiest days. Nor are these discoveries limited to the investigations of the miner or alone confined to the limits of our own territory, but the Catholic fathers in British Columbia have made equally rich discoveries at the headwaters of the Saskatchewan River and at Chief Mountain Lake, so that now gold is being profitably taken out at the following points: at John Day's, Grand Ronde, Powder River, Burnt and Boise, Owyhee Rivers, and in East Oregon. In the Nez Perce mines, Salmon River, Spokane, Clark's Fork, Similkameen, and Deer Lodge in East Washington Territory, and at Big Hole, Beaver Head, and Prickly Pear in West Dakota. The result of Captain Reynolds' explorations would show that traces of gold were found by his party in all the tributaries to the Upper Yellowstone from the south. Enough discoveries have been made to warrant us in thinking that the entire mountain system will be found to be gold-bearing. Gold has also been discovered in the Big Blackfoot, Flathead, Kootenai, and Bitterroot Rivers, and slight traces in the Coeur d'Alene and St. Regis Borgia. I do not hesitate to say, upon the best of guidance, that the lower Clark's Fork will yet prove a rich gold region. The richest quartz leads yet found are in the John Days. The other diggings are mostly surface or placer. Wonderful have been the effects of this great alchemist in that quarter. It has transmuted sluggishness into activity, has brightened the dullest vision, elevated the industrious and frugal laborer, silenced the skeptic and cavalier, and struck a new blow in behalf of a Northern Pacific Railroad route. The trade and travel along the Upper Columbia, where several steamers now ply between busy marts of themselves, attest that what magical effects 3 years have wrought. Besides gold, lead for miles is found along the Kootenai. Red hematite iron ore traces of copper and plumbago are found along the main Bitterroot. Cinnabar is said to exist along the Hell's Gate and at a point along the Upper Missouri. Coal is found along the Upper Missouri, and a deposit of cannel coal near the Three Buttes, northwest of Fort Benton, is said to exist. Near the headwaters of the Kootenai, coal is also said to exist. Coal may yet be looked for east of the Cascades. Iron ore has been found near Thompson's Prairie on the Clark's Fork. Sulfur is found on the Lolo Fork and on the tributaries to the Yellowstone. And a coal oil spring is said to exist on the Bighorn River, a tributary to the Yellowstone. It would be natural to suppose that the Rocky Mountain system, which beginning far down in Mexico, there develops its wealth in gold and silver, and continuing northward to Pike's Peak, would still retain its same geological characteristics as we trace them northward. And this we find to be the case, and on both slopes, at about the same altitude above the sea, do we find these rich deposits. What is true here is also true on the Coast Range, so that the Sierra Nevadas of California do not lose any of these characteristics when they become the Cascades of Oregon. We find that though for many years the gold region was limited to the western slopes and spurs of the Sierra Nevada, yet mineralogy pointed out that a Washoe must exist, and hence developments of fabulous wealth were made on the east slopes of the Sierra Nevadas, only to be followed by equally rich deposits now being worked on the eastern slopes of the Cascades in Oregon. These great mineral deposits must have an ultimate bearing upon the location of the Pacific Railroad, adding as they will trade, travel, and wealth to its every mile when built. Building material. The great depots for building material, stone, timber, and limestone, exist principally in the mountain sections, but the plains on either side are not destitute of this particular. White and red fir and yellow and white pine are found at Walla Walla in the Blue Mountains on the Clearwater, where cedar is added, and all through the Bitterroot and Rocky Mountains, the finest white and red cedar, white pine, and red fir that I have ever seen are found. Between the Coeur d'Alene Mission and Hell's Gate, spruce, hemlock, and birch are also found. The elevation at the Dalles and the line of longitude passing through it is the eastern limit of oak, which is traced from the coast eastward. We have no hardwoods in this region, and indeed nearly all the hardwoods used in California and Oregon are shipped around Cape Horn. Even the oak found in the Pacific is of an inferior growth, generally wind-shaken, and but little used in the mechanical arts. Timber is found until within 120 miles of Fort Benton. It grows also along the Upper Missouri and all its tributaries where it can be rafted down. All the rivers here lend themselves admirably to rafting purposes. Limestone is found on the Clearwater near the Coeur d'Alene Lake, in the Coeur d'Alene Mountains, in Hell's Gate, in the Bitterroot Valley, and head of the North Fork of the Little Blackfoot River. Beautiful red sandstone is found along the Bitterroot River. Slates are found along the Coeur d'Alene, St. Regis Borgia, and Bitterroot. Excellent gray sandstone is found in the Bitterroot Mountains, from which grindstones and scythe stones have been made, and good burr stones for mills have been got out of the mountains and used by the Jesuit fathers. Good sand is found along the Columbia, along the Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, and along the Hell's Gate rivers. Rivers and watercourses. The entire length of road from the Columbia to the Missouri may be said to follow one continuous line of watercourses, one of the chief recommendations of which is that not one is alkaline, but the water is of a delicious purity. This fact, on a long line of march with much stock, is an advantage that all who have crossed the plains will not fail to appreciate. In the first stretch of 50 miles, we cross the Walla Walla, Mill Creek, Dry Creek, and Toochee River. They all rise in the Blue Mountains, the last three flowing into the Walla Walla River and the last into the Columbia at the town of Wallula. The Snake River, or the South Fork of the Columbia, is the most considerable stream crossed. It rises in the Wind River Mountains and is about 1,000 miles long. It is navigated by steamers of heavy draft as far as Lewiston till the 1st of August, and light draft steamers have run as late as the 29th of September, and during the coming year it is proposed to run steamers as far as Fort Boise to supply the mines on either side at this point. Steamers have run up the clear water above the Lapway, but only during the highest stage of water. There is no timber along this portion of the Snake River, and steamers have to depend on driftwood, of which there has always been ample up to date. But fuel can be rafted down from the clear water. The importance of the Snake River for purposes of steam navigation begins now to be thoroughly appreciated. The cost of transportation is a large item, but as long as the mines continue to pay as well as they now do, so long will it pay to run steamers on this river. The scale upon which nature has worked in this region is wonderful, though she has interposed great physical obstacles, both in rivers and on land, to the opening of the country and speedy travel. She has nevertheless at the same time placed in the same region great areas of gold fields. The wealth from which is destined to so meet these obstacles that it is only a question of time when this region will boast of as rapid and as cheap travel as regions where the physical difficulties have been fewer. But the end sought not so stimulating as the search and mining of gold has proved to be. The next stream of note is the Palouse, which, rising in the Bitterroot Mountains, has a length of 90 miles, unsuited to either navigation or rafting purposes. Its banks are not timbered for the stretch of 40 miles from its mouth. Its minor tributaries, north and eastward, only enter as elements of advantage for camping purposes. The great number of lakes found on the plains of the Columbia enter as marked features in this immense area. Hangman's Creek rises in the Bitterroot Mountains as a length of 50 miles and empties into the Spokane, has no special value outside of affording camping facilities. The Spokane is the outlet of the Coeur d'Alene Lake, is 100 miles long and drains throughout a timbered region and enjoys special advantages for rafting purposes. Its mouth is the southern limit for timber along the main Columbia. Gold mines exist at and above its mouth. A project has been conceived to open a canal from the Clark's Fork at the Ponderay Lake to the Spokane. The elevation being suited for this purpose and the Clark's Fork with the Ponderay Lake offers marked advantages for steam navigation for at least 80 miles. My idea has always been that steam on the Clark's Fork at Park's Crossing, running 30 miles to the lake and 30 miles across the lake and 20 miles up the Clark's Fork, would reach a point where a cheap wagon road could be opened to the Hell's Gate, and that for all purposes of travel, carrying mails and immigrant purposes, that in time this would be done. I do not know what special advantages are expected to be derived from the canal referred to, nor do I think it will be undertaken unless this region should prove a very rich and extensive gold field. The Coeur d'Alene Lake and its two arms can be navigated by steam and enjoy special advantages for rafting purposes. The Clark's Fork, which is the middle fork of the Columbia, is a most important stream and enjoys preeminent advantages for rafting purposes. It is fed by two large forks, the Flathead River from the north and Bitterroot from the south. The St. Regis Borgia enjoys no special advantages outside of defining a valley and being useful for camping purposes. Its frequent crossings have rendered it rather an element of disadvantage. The Bitterroot River, with its three large tributaries, Big Blackfoot, Hell's Gate, and St. Mary's Rivers, enjoy special advantages for rafting purposes, and though here and there are stretches suited to steam navigation, yet broken as it is in its length by falls and rapids, precludes the possibility of its ever being used for such purposes. Crossing the Rocky Mountains, we find none of the tributaries of the Upper Missouri along our immediate line enjoying any special advantage except the Dearborn and Sun Rivers, both of which might be used for rafting timber and stone from their headwaters. The Sun River, more so than the Dearborn, the Upper Missouri, with its three forks, enjoys special advantages both for navigation and rafting purposes. The distance from the falls of the Missouri to the Three Forks is about 175 miles, and though the water is rapid at a few points, yet in the lowest stage of water, steamers can run. And here is a field for enterprise and bold experiments never as yet tested, and which cannot lie dormant if the Prickly Pear, Deer Lodge, and Beaverhead mines prove a growing reality. At present, steamers from St. Louis land at Fort Benton, but they can run 40 miles further to the foot of the falls. If steamers are put on above the falls, a portage of 15 miles becomes necessary. The mouth of the small creek from the south, called Portage Creek, affords a good landing site. The river from this point to Fort Benton is broad and bold, with plenty of cottonwood fuel on the small creek and on the main river. The portage will have to be made on the south bank, as the great number of coulees in broken country on the north bank will render a road expensive, if not impracticable. On the south bank, by keeping back, say, 2 or 3 miles from the river, we head all the coulees and have a level and beautiful plain till reaching the head of the falls, when you descend to the river bank by a gradual slope at the White Bear Islands, just below the mouth of Sun River, where the Missouri is again a clear, bold, and placid stream. The Great Falls of the Missouri form the only feature of great beauty in this region and are well worthy a visit. The falls begin 9 miles below the mouth of Sun River and continue in a stretch of 13 miles with rapids, falls, and cascades, gaining in this distance a total fall of 380 feet. The lower falls are the largest, being 84 feet, where the stream is 480 yards wide, the southern half of which, in a single sheet, leaps over a ledge of sandstone rocks, while the northern half, in a series of falls, cascades, and chutes, makes a broken descent into the basin lying at its foot. The whole rock formation here is a yellow sandstone, and the character given to the falls has depended upon the ease or difficulty with which the water has either washed the rock away to a sharp face, as in the southern half, or worn it away into plateaus and benches, as in the northern half. A high prominent bank projects into the river at the foot of the falls from the northern bank, from which you enjoy a beautiful view. The water, the rock thinly veiled in foam, the high, bold banks, the wildness of the scene so far from civilization, the thundering noise of the fall of the cataract, the rising of the mist, the tout ensemble constituted a picture worthy the pencil of the artist and the toil of the tourist. The upper but smaller falls are 40 feet high but very beautiful. Between the upper and lower are the horseshoe and other falls from 3 to 15 feet. The banks on either side continue to retain throughout this entire length their wild, rocky, rugged character, so that the Missouri itself plows in a deep, narrow gorge 1,000 feet below the general line of the plains that bound it on either side. The special advantages enjoyed by the Columbia and Missouri rivers, rising as they do in the same sources in the Rocky Mountains and flowing thousands of miles into two oceans, must ever enter an essential and economical elements into trade, travel, and railroad construction across the continent. The Columbia is the only stream that rises in the main chain of the Rocky Mountains, breaking through the Coast Range and emptying into the Pacific. The large watercourses with their great network of tributaries lying between the 44th and 49th degrees of north latitude must ever cause this region to enjoy facilities given by nature to no other west of the Mississippi. These large bodies of water tend to modify the climate, supply mill sites, water farms, and grazing fields, enable the miner to work miles of sluice boxes, the merchant to float by steam his wares to the very heart of the Rocky Range, and stand ever ready and panting to be converted into steam for the iron horse that must soon invade these dominions. Mountain system. The early geographers who attempted the mapping of the country west of the Missouri left us a very vague and erroneous outline of the Rocky Mountain formation or the direction of the vast system of spurs that go to form them. The dividing ridge of the Rocky Range was nearly always represented as a right line trending from northwest to southeast from our northern boundary to New Mexico. This right line has, however, disappeared from our maps as explorations have brought in from year to year the results of their searches. The greatest deviation from a right line that occurs in close proximity to our road exists from the head of Deer Lodge Valley to the Wind River chain, where the mountains enclose in a large re-entering angle the Big Hole Valley. I look forward to seeing this section become a great center both for mining and agricultural developments. Our barometer detects this fact that all the waters of Clark's Fork, with the Bitterroot, Hell's Gate, St. Mary's, and Big Blackfoot, flow in a basin elevated above the waters of the plains by the Columbia by 700 feet and above the plains of the Missouri by 500 feet. The waters of the South Fork of the Columbia, rising as far south as the 40th parallel of latitude, all flow northward. So also the Missouri and the Yellowstone, showing that they rise in higher mountains and necessarily the points to which they flow must be lower. And hence, as you go northward within certain limits, the country must be lower, and the mountain passes have a less altitude above the sea level. Our barometer confirms this theory, and hence from the 42nd to the 48th parallel, you will find the lowest passes in the Rocky Range. The mountain formation with their great system of spurs can only be likened to a coral formation, as difficult to delineate on the maps, and following a rule as difficult to describe. Indians along the road. The Indians met with along the line are the Palouse, Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, Flatheads, Ponderay, a few Snakes, and Bannocks, the Blackfeet, and the Mountain Nez Perce. The Walla Wallas and the Cayuse have all been removed to the agency on the Umatilla. The Palouse number about 200 reside on the banks of the Snake and Palouse rivers and live solely by fishing. I do not know that they cultivate the soil. The absence of any great amount of farming land in their country has always possibly prevented them from attempting it. They have no treaty arrangements with the government, and I think they could be assigned to the Nez Perce Reservation with advantage to the government and security to themselves. They are miserable creatures, have neither houses nor lodges, but live under wicker shelters. They own very few horses. The Spokanes number about 500, live by fishing and cultivating small patches of land. They reside at times on the Spokane, at times on the Spokane Plains, have lodges and houses, and are superior to the Palouse. They have no treaty with the government, and they might, with the Colville Indians, be located near the military post of Fort Colville. They are friendly when it is in their interest. The Coeur d'Alenes number about 300, live at the Mission and along the Coeur d'Alene and St. Joseph Rivers. They own houses, cattle, and canoes, and with the Spokanes and Nez Perce often cross the mountains in quest of buffalo. They live by hunting, fishing, and cultivating the soil. They have no treaty with the government, and I think they should be moved to the Flathead Reservation. They live partly in log houses, mostly in skin lodges. The Flatheads number about 400 and live by hunting and cultivating the soil. They are the best Indians in the mountains. They have treaty arrangements with the government, but have never gone upon their reservations on the Jocko River. No steps have ever been taken to remove them thence, and they still reside in St. Mary's Valley, which by the terms of the treaty was guaranteed to them. They think the government has not kept its faith in not confirming this valley to them. Under judicious management, they and the Ponderays might be made to go upon a joint reservation contemplated in a treaty made with them by Governor Stevens. They own great numbers of horses and cattle and cultivate the soil more than any Indians except the Ponderay. They are friendly, and under their chiefs, Victor, Ambrose, and Moisey, will always remain so unless some great injustice is done to them. They and the Ponderay go annually to the buffalo hunt on the plains of the Missouri. They live partly in houses, mostly in skin lodges. The Ponderays reside principally at the Ponderay Mission, live by hunting, fishing, and cultivating the soil. As a tribe, they are friendly, though there are some bad fellows among them. They number about 500 souls and have treaty arrangements with the government, though they have never moved onto their reservation. The Mountain Nez Perce number 1 to 200 live and hunt with the Flatheads are an annoyance both to them and the whites. They should be either incorporated with the Flatheads or made to live with their tribe. They are generally disaffected and cause much trouble and disturbance in the country. With the Flatheads are found a few Indians of the Iroquois, Shawnee, and Snakes, and one or two New Mexican Indians. They all find a friendly and welcome home with the Flatheads, into which tribe they have married. Occasionally, a few Snakes and Bannocks come to the Deer Lodge Valley. They live generally in the Beaverhead and on the Salmon River. I do not know their number or condition. I only know they are adept horse thieves, have no treaty arrangements with the government, and need to be looked after both for the security of the frontier settlements and their own good. I especially invite the attention of the Indian Department to the necessity of having some arrangements with the Snakes, Bannocks, and Spokanes, and point the Beaverhead out as a suitable point for collecting them on a general reservation where a large military post should be established to keep them in order. The Blackfeet number from 8,000 to 10,000 souls and live exclusively by hunting buffalo. They live partly in our territory to the north of Fort Benton and partly in British territory. They have treaty arrangements with the government, and in the absence of military force to control them, keep their faith as well as could be expected from wild savages. They are rich in horses and wives, for they are perfect Mormons in polygamy, and all the other tribes practice monogamy. They are great horse thieves, though I never suffered from this propensity, to which they are greatly addicted. As a people, these Indians have a high regard for the rights of Meum and Tuum as their superiors, the whites, and if their true condition was known at the Indian Bureau, I am sanguine an improvement for the better would take place. With the present system at the Bureau, however, I can only expect to see experiments and changes made until the Indian has disappeared. The present Superintendent of Indian Affairs in Washington Territory, Mr. C.E. Hale, has instituted a project that I have long endorsed and the only one likely to save any portion of the Indian tribes. This is to take the children and educate them under a proper system, for it is as difficult to mold the ideas and acts of an Indian after he has passed the age of 21 as it is those of his white neighbor. And it is only by taking the children and rescuing them from sloth and ignorance and the savage propensities that any decided improvement can be obtained. For myself, I should like to see the supervision of the Indians transferred to the War Department so that the hand that rewards should be the one to punish when needed, and thus produce a more uniform and harmonious management, giving greater security against outbreak and a more economical administration of the finances of the government. If this cannot be done, of which I despair, since it aims a blow at executive patronage, then I should by all means advocate that the Superintendent of Indian Affairs be allowed to appoint his own agents. This is as natural as it is just. The agent should be directly responsible to the superintendent whom the government has charged with their general supervision, and this supervision cannot be properly maintained when the agency receives their authority, agent receives their authority from another and different source, and are thus inclined to slight, if not ignore, his authority. The sphere of duties of the superintendent should never be so great as to prevent them from visiting every agency once a year. In Oregon and Washington, this is impracticable, and I would therefore recommend the establishment of a Rocky Mountain Superintendency with its headquarters in the Deer Lodge Valley, and to include the Blackfeet, Crows, Snakes, Bannocks, Flatheads, Ponderays, and Kootenays, and that the supplies for this superintendency be taken from St. Louis by steamer to Fort Benton. Four agents and a sub-agent would be required, an agent for the Blackfeet, one for the Crows, one for the Snakes and Bannocks, one for the Flatheads and Ponderays, and a sub-agent for the Kootenays. This matter is well worthy the attention of the Indian Department, and to it I invite their attention on a score of economy, efficiency, and security for the future. Population. The white population, made up of Americans, French, and others, on and tributary to the road, may be estimated at 10,000, found mostly at Walla Walla and Lewiston, Deer Lodge, Hell's Gate, Beaver Head, Big Hole, bitterroot, and prickly pear. They are engaged in farming, mining, transporting, merchandising, and the mechanic arts. As the mines develop, this population will be largely added to annually, both by immigrants by way of the Missouri and from California. Already is activity infused into every branch of business, and the prospect for the future are flattering to the extreme. Two weekly papers are published in this region, at Walla Walla, the Statesman, and at Lewiston, the Golden Age. Schools and academies and churches already rear their heads, and a great number of books purchased and papers subscribed to bespeak the intelligence of the people. Every nationality from John Chinaman to the Englishman and every state in the Union are here represented, but notwithstanding the variety of languages spoken and views entertained, harmony in counsel and uniformity in action as yet pervade and mark the body politic. Catholic missions. The Jesuit Catholic Fathers have three missions established along the line of the road, one among the Coeur d'Alenes, one among the Pend'Oreilles and Flatheads, and one among the Blackfeet. The first site of the Coeur d'Alene mission was in the St. Joseph's Valley, but the overflow of the stream and the many difficulties to which they were subjected at this point compelled them in 1846 to abandon it in favor of its present site on the Coeur d'Alene River. They have erected here a fine church, dwellings, and such other buildings as are necessary for their wants. The Indians are educated not only to worship God, but every attention is given to teach them to till the soil. The missions use Indian labor exclusively under the direction of three lay brothers and are supported from a small fund for the propagation of the Catholic faith, which is devoted exclusively to the purchase of those articles which they themselves cannot produce or make. They are thrifty and frugal, and by their zeal in the cause and devotion to the best interest of the Indians for whom they have given their lives a voluntary offering, they wield an influence among the better portion such as no whites or government agents have ever been enabled to obtain. Far removed as yet from contact with civilization, their lives of upright moral rectitude, zeal in behalf of the Indian, their morning, noon, and night devotion when all the tribes assemble and chant paeans to the Almighty, the perfect harmony that exists in their social family of Indians and half-breeds has ever won my highest admiration. In all that tended towards the ultimate success of my movements, I have ever enjoyed their kind cooperation and zealous support, and during the many years spent near their mountain homes, the kindest and warmest relations have ever existed between us. The fathers in abiding among the red men have but one object in view, to rescue them from the blighting effects of ignorance and superstition, and to reclaim them from the effects of an advancing civilization, which to them is death. I can only regret that the results as yet obtained would not seem commensurate with the endeavors so manly put forth. The only good, however, that I have ever seen effected among these people has been due to the exertions of these Catholic missionaries. Many of these missions might be benefited by the government allowing them the change of the schools and hospitals, the charge of the schools and hospitals, for they actually take care of the Indians when sick and educate them when well, and all this with the mere pittance at their disposal, not a moiety of what they need, while hundreds and thousands are squandered on paper for the benefit of the Indians in which they never receive. The Coeur d'Alene mission has the fathers Josette and Gazzoli and brothers Francis McGuire and Campapiano. They have chosen a beautiful site on a hill in the middle of the Mission Valley, and it has always proved to the weary traveler and destitute immigrant a St. Bernard in the Coeur d'Alene Mountains. I fear that the location of our road and the swarms of miners and immigrants that must pass here year after year will so militate against the best interests of the mission that its present site will have to be changed or abandoned. This for themselves and the Indians is to be regretted, for I can only regard it as the inevitable result of opening and settling the country. I have seen enough of Indians to convince me of this fact, that they can never exist in contact with the whites, and their only salvation is to be removed far, far from their presence. But they have been removed so often that there seems now no place left for their further migration. The waves of civilization have invaded their homes from both oceans, driving them year after year towards the Rocky Mountains, and now that we propose to invade these mountain solitudes to wrest from them their hidden wealth, where under heavens can the Indians go? And may we not expect to see these people make one desperate struggle in the fastness of the Rocky Mountains for the maintenance of their last homes and the preservation of their lives? It is a matter that but too strongly commends itself to the early and considerate attention of the general government. The Indian is destined to disappear before the white man, and the only question is how it may be best done. And his disappearance from our midst, tempered with those elements calculated to produce to himself the least amount of suffering and to us the least amount of cost. The Pendre Mission is pleasantly situated on Mission Creek, a few miles to the north of the Jocko Reservation, where Fathers Minitre, Louis Vera Cruz, and Greasy preside, and with two lay brothers. They have here, as at the Coeur d'Alene Mission, a complete set of buildings for their residences and a beautiful church. Here, too, Indian labor is employed. The original site of this mission was on the Clark's Fork, about 50 miles from Fort Colville, where the Lower Pendre Indians lived. But finding at this point more soil to cultivate and a better site, they removed hither in 1855, bringing many of the Lower Pendres with them. They have besides a branch mission at Fort Colville, visited from time to time by Father Josette. They had a mission at the present site of Fort Owen till 1850, when it was abandoned, and the property sold to Major John Owen, where he now resides, having a pleasant home and the finest library I have seen on the North Pacific coast. The next mission is among the Blackfeet, but as yet not much headway has been made towards its permanent establishment. The Fathers chose a site on Sun River, 10 miles above the wagon road crossing, where they erected a few buildings, but they never enclosed fields, and last year it was abandoned. They then held service at and occupied the site of old Fort Campbell, a mile above Fort Benton. While I was at this point last summer, they were projecting a site on the Marias with a view to there establish their permanent homes. The extent of good soil, its mild climate, its proximity to the homes of the Blackfeet, and its distance from the line of travel all combine to determine them in its selection. At present, the superior is Father Giorda, who has his headquarters at Fort Benton. The superior for many years while I was in the mountains was Father Congiato, from whom I have received many kindnesses and courtesies, but he being assigned to the presidency of one of the colleges at San Francisco compelled a change. Father Imoda and Giorda, with two lay brothers, are at the Blackfeet Mission. The country and the Indians are mainly indebted to the zealous labor of the Reverend Father De Smet in establishing all these missions, for he truly is the great father of all Rocky Mountain missionaries. By his travels and his labors and the dedication of his years to this noble task, he has left a name in the mountains revered by all who knew him, and a household god with every Indian who respects the black gown. His early work, called the Oregon Missions, is replete with interesting information, and from which we ourselves have collected many geographical and statistical facts. To him and his co-laborers in their self-sacrificing work, I return my thanks for their many kindnesses, with the hope that they may live to see the full fruits of their zeal and toil amid the fastness and solitudes of the Rocky Mountains. Climate, snow, and cold. There has been no one subject so little understood or so much misrepresented as the climate of the northern valleys of the Rocky Mountains and the plains extending to their either base. I am frank to admit that the section of our road from the Coeur d'Alene Mission to the Bitterroot Ferry does interpose the obstruction of snow to such an extent that I despair of seeing it traveled in winter, unless a daily mail coach is placed upon the line, when the snow, being beaten down twice a day, would, I think, keep the line constantly open. But all the remaining sections are mild, with so little snow that traveling with horses can be kept up all winter. And although the climate in the region first referred to is severe, by going north to the Clark's Fork, we at once enter a milder section, and one that offers every advantage to travel. The temperature of Walla Walla is 46 degrees, is similar to that of Washington City in 38 degree latitude, that of the Clark's Fork is in 48 degrees to that of St. Joseph's, Missouri in latitude 41 degrees. That of the Bitterroot Valley in 46 degrees is similar to that of Philadelphia in latitude 40 degrees, with about the same amount of snow and with the exception of a few days of intense cold, about the same average temperature. This condition of facts is not accidental, but rises from the truths of meteorological laws that are as unvarying as they are wonderful and useful. As early as the winter of 1853, which I spent in these mountains, my attention was called to the mild, open region lying between the Deer Lodge Valley and Fort Laramie, where the buffalo roamed in millions through the winter, and which during that season constituted the great hunting grounds of the Crow, Blackfeet, and other mountain tribes. Upon investigating the peculiarities of the country, I learned from the Indians, and afterwards confirmed by my own explorations, the fact of the existence of an infinite number of hot springs at the headwaters of the Missouri, Columbia, and Yellowstone rivers, and that hot geysers, similar to those of California, existed at the head of the Yellowstone, that this line of hot springs was traced to the Bighorn, where a coal oil spring, similar in all respects to those worked in West Pennsylvania and Ohio, exists, and where I am sanguine in believing that the whole country is underlaid with immense coal fields. Here, then, was a feature sufficient to create great modifications of climate, not local in its effect, but which even extends for several hundred miles from the Red Buttes on the Platte to the plains of the Columbia. The meteorological statistics collected during a great number of years have enabled us to trace an isocheminal line across the continent from St. Joseph's, Missouri to the Pacific, and the direction taken by this line is wonderful and worthy the most important attention in all future legislation that looks towards the travel and settlement of this country. This line, which leaves St. Joseph's in latitude 40 degrees, follows the general line of the Platte to Fort Laramie, where, from newly introduced causes, it tends northwestwardly between the Wind River chain and the Black Hills, crossing the summit of the Rocky Mountains in latitude 47, showing that in the interval from St. Joseph's, it had gained 6 degrees of latitude. Tracing it still further westward, it goes as high as 48 degrees and develops itself in a fan-like shape in the plains of the Columbia. From Fort Laramie to the Clark's Fork, I call this an atmospheric river of heat, varying in width from 1 to 100 miles. On its either side, north and south, are walls of cold air, and which are so clearly perceptible that you always detect when you are upon its shores. It would seem natural that the large volume of air in motion between the Wind River chain and the Black Hills must receive a certain amount of heat as it passes over the line of hot boiling springs here found, which, added to the great heat evolved from the large volumes of water here existing, which is constantly cumulative, must all tend to modify its temperatures to the extent that the thermometer detects. The prevalent direction of the winds, the physical face of the country, its altitude, and the large volume of water all doubtless enter to create this modification. But from whatsoever cause it arises, it exists as a fact that must for all time enter as an element worthy of every attention in the lines of travel and communication from the eastern plains to the North Pacific. A comparison of the altitude of the South Pass with the country on its every side with Mullins Pass further to the north may be useful in this connection. The South Pass has an altitude of 7,489 feet above the level of the sea. The Wind River chain to its north rises till it attains at Fremont's Peak an elevation of 13,570 feet, while to the north the mountains increase in altitude till they attain at Long's Peak an elevation of 15,000 feet, while the plains to the east have an elevation of 6,000 feet, and the mountains to the west, forming the east rim of the Great Basin, have an elevation of 8,234 feet, and the country between it and the South Pass have an elevation of 6,234 feet above the level of the sea. The highest point on the road in the summit line at Mullins Pass has an elevation of 6,000 feet, which is lower by 1,489 feet than the South Pass. Allowing what we find to be here the case, viz., 280 feet of altitude for each degree of temperature, we see that Mullins Pass enjoys 6 degrees of milder temperature due to this difference of altitude alone. At the South Pass are many high snow peaks at Fremont's Peak, Three Tetons, Laramie Peak, Long's Peak, and others, all of which must tend to modify the temperature. Whereas to the north, we have no high snow peaks, but the mountains have a general elevation of from 5,000 to 8,000 feet above the level of the sea, and of most marked uniformity in point of altitude.